I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
So back in the spring of 2016, we did a podcast on Zheng-He. Remember Zheng-He?
I do indeed.
Zheng-He led a fleet of treasure ships on huge and far-reaching voyages from China to Southern Asia, the Arabian Peninsula, and Eastern Africa in the 15th century. And one of the points we made in that episode was that it wasn't necessarily accurate to call Zheng-He an explorer, because he wasn't so much exploring as following routes that were known already. And we said that in some cases, they were actually routes that a man named Ibn Battuta had traveled from the opposite direction a century before. Today, we are finally going to talk about Abu Abdullah Muhammad Ibn Abdullah Ibn Ibrahim Alawati Al-Tanji Ibn Battuta, who has been requested by some listeners, including Julie and Jennifer, and he's commonly just known as Ibn Battuta. Like Zheng-He, Ibn Battuta wasn't so much an explorer. His travels took him to places that were already known within the Muslim world, and they were part of that world. Mostly, he traveled along well-traveled routes, but these travels were extensive. He was away from home for roughly 24 years, and during that time traveled through virtually every Muslim nation and territory, becoming the traveler of the age.
Ibn Battuta was born on February 25th, 1304, which was the year 703 in the Islamic calendar. We found multiple different conversions of the exact date in the Islamic calendar, so keep that in mind.
They differed by 1 to 2 days, and I don't trust my own conversion enough to rely on that.
He was born in Tangier, which is a port city in Morocco, and although it wasn't Morocco's busiest port, Tangier's position between the Mediterranean and the Atlantic meant that it was a frequent departure point for ships bound across the Strait of Gibraltar to the Iberian Peninsula, or to other parts of Europe and Africa. And this meant that although Tangier was a Muslim city, it also saw lots of Christian visitors and merchants who arrived from places like Genoa, Marseille, and Majorca.
Apart from the father and grandfather who were referenced in his name, Ibn means son of, we don't really know a lot about Ibn Battuta's family. They were Sunni Muslims who were of an indigenous North African people known as the Lawata, and several were qadis or judges, or they were otherwise scholars of Islamic law.
Ibn Battuta's upbringing was probably typical for a Muslim child living in Northern Africa in the 14th century. He would have attended school either at a mosque or through a private tutor. His early education would have focused on the Quran, along with subjects like arithmetic and grammar and literature and history. For students from more prominent families, which Ibn Battuta was, more advanced study followed as children got older.
We do know for sure that Ibn Battuta's study of the Quran and of Islamic law were really lifelong. He learned the whole Quran by heart, and he wrote of reciting it to himself from beginning to end as he traveled, sometimes twice when he felt like he needed to bolster himself up a little more.
And when he was 21 by the Gregorian calendar and 22 by the Islamic lunar calendar, Ibn Battuta began preparing for the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca that is one of the five pillars of Islam. And this was for him a religious duty. It's an obligation for all Muslims who are physically and financially able to go and whose families won't be harmed by their being away. And it was also something he genuinely wanted to do, describing himself as, quote, swayed by an overmastering impulse within me and a desire long cherished in my bosom to visit these illustrious sanctuaries.
Ibn Battuta's pilgrimage was also an opportunity to further his education. Although Tangier was a notable port city, it wasn't particularly known for its scholars and it didn't have a college. So Ibn Battuta's pilgrimage would allow him to study with legal scholars and with Sufi mystics in cities like Tunis, Alexandria, and Cairo along the way.
Studying with more prominent scholars was an opportunity for Ibn Battuta to deepen his own knowledge of Islamic law. It's the body of guiding rules and principles that govern Muslims' daily lives and worship, also known as Sharia. And enhancing his legal training would give him access to more prestigious work. But this wasn't simply a means to moving up a career ladder, because the law Ibn Battuta was studying was rooted in the Islamic faith and was inseparable from that faith. His religious and legal educations were also inseparable from one another.
On top of the intertwined nature of his religious and legal education, the concept of seeking knowledge is an important part of Islam in general. Both the Quran and the Hadith, which is a record of the sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad, have multiple references to learning and seeking knowledge, including how to seek knowledge in a way that's ethical and compatible with Islam. So essentially, seeking knowledge is an act of worship, and it's incumbent upon all Muslims to learn.
One hadith that frequently comes up in relation to Ibn Battuta is seek knowledge even as far as China. Although there are some questions about whether that one is correctly attributed, those same basic concepts are definitely present in others.
Ibn Battuta left for Mecca on June 14th of 1325, which was the year 725 in the Islamic calendar. Although many pilgrims traveled to Mecca as part of an official organized caravan, and Ibn Battuta may have been planning to join a caravan later on in the journey, he initially set off alone over land following the North African coast.
And even though Ibn Battuta embarked alone, the Hajj is an annual religious observance. So other Muslims were also setting out for Mecca on their own pilgrimages, generally following the same roads and routes through northern Africa. So after about 3 weeks, he fell in with two companions, although they separated after they both got sick due to the severe summer heat. One companion actually died, and the other returned that person's body home. A little later in the journey across northern Africa, Ibn Battuta fell ill as well, one of several serious illnesses he contracted during his travels. When someone suggested he stay in a town for a while to recover, Ibn Battuta replied, "If God decrees my death, it shall be on the road with my face set toward the land of Hijaz."
As he traveled, Ibn Battuta would stop for a time in cities and towns, and the length of his stay would depend on everything from his health to the travel conditions to whether there were important scholars in residence. For example, he spent 2 months in Tunis studying at the College of the Booksellers and being appointed qadi of a pilgrim caravan when he left there.
He also entered into a marriage contract with the daughter of a Tunisian official who was part of that caravan. The two men eventually had some kind of falling out and broke that contract. Shortly thereafter, Ibn Battuta entered into a marriage contract with a different woman, the daughter of another pilgrim who was a scholar from Fez. And she would be the first of several wives and concubines, some of them enslaved, that Ibn Battuta would bring into his life.
Ibn Battuta and the company of pilgrims he was traveling with arrived in Alexandria at the Nile River Delta in the early spring of 1326. He stayed there for about a month, visiting holy sites, studying, and also doing some sightseeing, including touring the city's textile district. But eventually he decided it was time to move on again. The timing of his journey and the time that he'd spent in Alexandria meant that at this point he wasn't lined up with the season for pilgrimage caravans anymore. So there was no official company for him to join. He was once again on his own.
His plan was to follow the banks of the Nile River south to a town near the modern border with Sudan. And from there he would travel overland to the Red Sea, board a boat to Jeddah, and travel overland from there to Mecca.
The trip up the Nile took about 3 weeks, but then when he got to the Red Sea, it turned out that most of the boats in the port had been destroyed during a dispute between the local ruling family and the governor. So he had to turn back, this time taking a boat down the Nile, getting back to Alexandria in about 8 days, spending one night there before leaving for Syria.
And the reason he only spent one night was that at this point, the season for official travel to Mecca was approaching. And he thought if he made good enough time, he could join a caravan leaving out of Damascus. On the way, he stayed for about a week in Jerusalem. But even so, he got to Damascus with enough time to spare that he stayed there for nearly a month. Although he had been continuing his studies throughout the trip, in Damascus, he continued them formally, earning several official certifications in different law texts.
In Damascus, Ibn Battuta finally did join an official caravan bound for Mecca that he stayed with for the rest of the trip there, which we will talk about after a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing. And no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ibn Battuta set out with a large caravan of pilgrims from Damascus on September 1st, 1326. This was more than a year after leaving his home in Tangier. He doesn't specifically say how many people were in this caravan, but it was likely several thousand. Official caravans traveling to Mecca were and are very large. First, they went to Medina, which is about 820 miles or roughly 1,300 kilometers away from Damascus, and the travel there took about 50 days. Once there, pilgrims took part in several days of religious rituals, including at the Mosque of the Prophet. And then from Medina, it was another 200 miles or 320 kilometers to Mecca, where Ibn Battuta finally arrived in October of 1326.
After the Hajj, which involves several days of religious observances and rituals, most pilgrims returned home. But Ibn Battuta did not. Early in his journey, he'd had a dream of a great bird sweeping him away over a far distance. He'd also met an ascetic who told him that he would meet and offer greetings to the ascetic's three brothers, one in India, one in Sindh, and one in China. Sindh is now Pakistan. But aside from these more romantic ideas, Ibn Battuta thought that if he continued to travel, he could continue to learn and to find work as a qadi. And instead of turning west toward home, he went north and then east toward what's now Iraq in the company of returning pilgrims from that region.
Although he did make several stops along the way, his primary goal at this point was to visit the city of Baghdad. Baghdad had been besieged and then sacked during the Mongol invasion in 1258, and that was a little less than 70 years before Ibn Battuta's arrival. That sacking is generally considered to be the end of the Islamic Golden Age. So when Ibn Battuta went there, he was envisioning it as sort of witnessing one of the great cities that had been. He also stopped in most of the major cities in the area and took a tour up the Tigris River.
From there, he returned to Mecca with another Hajj caravan, this time staying for at least a year, during which time he both studied and performed the rituals associated with the lesser pilgrimage a number of times.
He left Mecca again in either 1328 or 1330. Exactly when is a little bit unclear, but whichever it was, he spent the next 2 years traveling mainly by boat to cities along the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Arabian Sea. He went as far south as Kilwa on the African coast in what's now Tanzania, but was at the time part of the Kilwa Sultanate. After 2 years of mostly seafaring wandering, he once again joined a pilgrimage caravan to Mecca, traveling overland across the entirety of the Arabian Peninsula before observing the Hajj for a third time.
By this point, Ibn Battuta had learned that the Sultan of Delhi, Muhammad Tughluq, had invited scholars to India, and that many who made their way there were finding themselves with prestigious appointments that came along with lavish gifts. The Sultan had made a practice of specifically filling posts with foreign visitors, and Ibn Battuta hoped to be one of them. But to get there and to get an appointment, he needed a guide who spoke Persian, knew India well, and had contacts there who could help Ibn Battuta on his way.
His initial plan seems to have been to try to find such a guide in Jeddah and then to have a relatively straightforward sea voyage to India. But he couldn't find someone with the skills and connections that he needed. So instead, he set off on a much, much more circuitous route overland, perhaps thinking that he might meet someone along the way.
He first made his way back to Cairo, and from there to the port city of Latakia on the Syrian coast, before taking a ship across the Mediterranean Sea to Alanya in Anatolia, on the coast of what is now Turkey. And he then undertook a very roundabout 2-year trek that went to Constantinople through the Byzantine Empire, across the Asian steppe, and then through Afghanistan, finally crossing the Indus River in 1333 or 1335. He essentially went quite far to the north, following a zigzagging path between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea before dropping southeast into India.
If you look at a map, this was not just an indirect way to go. Crossing the Asian steppe was also far more difficult than going by sea or by following some of the other overland routes. Taking the path that was both the long way and the hard way may have been because Ibn Battuta had already seen several of the cities along the Arabian Sea that they would have passed through if he had gone that way instead. He had resolved to never travel a path that he had traveled before if there was some other option available.
That seems like it would get so problematic in a hurry. And apparently it did.
There are lots of maps of his voyages online, and there is very little, like, the arrow going two directions on the same path. And when it is, it's usually like, okay, yeah, there's not really a different way to go.
Ibn Battuta spent about 8 years in India, where he was named Qadi of Delhi, although for his first several months there, he spent his time accompanying the Sultan on hunting expeditions rather than hearing legal cases. He also had some trouble with money. He had purchased gifts for the Sultan, including horses, camels, and enslaved people along the way, with the hope that it was going to help him secure a good appointment. And although his appointment as Qadi came with an income, he just didn't have the same pool of wealth as many of the other Delhi elite to draw from. And he was expected to maintain an opulent lifestyle and to spend some of his income on gifts and payments to others, so he was soon in debt.
Apart from his financial problems, his years in India overall also weren't particularly easy due to a combination of famines, uprisings, and political intrigue. At this point, India had a majority Hindu population that was being ruled by a minority Muslim government, which led to ongoing uprisings and religious violence.
Around 1340, Ibn Battuta was appointed to lead an envoy from Delhi to China, and he left in the summer of 1341. He was tasked with ensuring the safety of a huge retinue, including hundreds of people, and gifts, including textiles, dishware, and weapons. Although they traveled under armed guard, they were attacked by Hindu insurgents only a few days out from Delhi. Ibn Battuta was attacked and robbed a second time while waiting for reinforcements after that first incident. And then he became lost for 6 days after escaping from his captors.
After this inauspicious beginning, the expedition ended disastrously in early 1342 when the whole fleet of 4 ships, at this point they had moved to a sea voyage, was forced aground and wrecked in a storm off the port of Calicut on the southwestern coast of India. Most of their retinue was also killed in this storm and shipwrecks, including the other 2 highest-ranking officials that had been dispatched from Delhi. Ibn Battuta only survived because he had moved from the junk where the diplomatic envoy was supposed to be sleeping to another ship because the room that was assigned to him on the diplomatic junk was just too small for his taste.
Although he wanted to return to Delhi and tell the Sultan what had happened, he didn't feel like he could, at least not right away. Not only had the entire retinue and all of its goods been lost on his watch, but he would also have to explain why he had survived while the other officials had not. He'd also lost nearly everything he had in that storm. He wound up stranded for months before finally finding passage to Honavar on the western coast of India on a fleet of ships that belonged to the Sultan.
Once he got there, though, the situation was not much better. He had hoped to find a patron and some kind of appointment that would allow him the time and the resources to figure out what he should do next, and perhaps even to recoup some of his lost income. Instead, he wound up spending most of the summer of 1342 in devotional seclusion, praying and reciting the Quran twice through every day. He was basically offered housing in a like this one person's room, and he was like, yeah, I don't really have work for you. You can stay here, though. So he basically stayed there in prayer for months.
And finally, he decided to go to China on his own, staying for a time in the Maldives and acting again as Qadi before going on to China by sea. By this point, he had been to so many places and could tell stories of so many other courts that he was received enthusiastically and he was compensated generously.
Once he left the Maldives, there's some dispute about exactly how far into China he did go, in part because he didn't give a lot of detail about China when he wrote about his travels. This lack of detail has led some critics to suggest that he did not go to China at all. And while he probably did not get nearly as far as the account of his trip suggests, with some of that probably being embellished when it was being written, he almost certainly did visit the more southeastern parts of China. His lack of detail is more likely because the Muslim population there was relatively small, and that was really what he was most interested in learning from and writing about. So he just had a lot less interest in China and a lot less to say about it.
And it was after visiting China that Ibn Battuta decided, at last, to return home after undertaking the Hajj one last time. We're going to talk about all of that after we have a little sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
So Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing. And no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally abandoning the idea of returning to India to explain what had happened to the convoy, Ibn Battuta began working his way toward home in 1347 by way of one last pilgrimage to Mecca. That would be his fourth during his lifetime. Rather than waiting for the next pilgrimage season, he took a wandering route through Persia, Iraq, Syria, and Egypt. And in Damascus, Syria, he learned that his father had died about 15 years before.
He decided to travel to Aleppo in the summer of 1348, which turned out to be just as the Black Death began moving through the region. And for the next several months, his travels took him through cities and towns that were ravaged by the plague. For a time, he got ahead of the spread of the disease, but it caught up with him again in Mecca, where he spent 4 months awaiting the Hajj.
After his fourth Hajj, he began traveling finally toward Tangier. But once he arrived there, after his decades of absence, he learned that his mother had died of the plague only about 6 months before.
Ibn Battuta didn't stay at home for long. He soon set out once again for a brief tour of Granada across the Strait of Gibraltar, followed by a return to Africa and a tour to the south, crossing the Sahara Desert to the Kingdom of Mali and the city of Timbuktu.
Ibn Battuta finally returned to Fez, which was then the capital of Morocco, in 1354. And as far as we know, he spent the rest of his life in or near Morocco. The Sultan, Abu Inan, asked him to write an account of his journey. And in doing this, Ibn Battuta worked with an amanuensis, Ibn Juzay, who was also a court poet. Ibn Juzay made his language poetic, added some actual poems, and probably embellished a few things while also bringing Ibn Battuta's account in line with literary standards of the time.
The end result of all this work was finished on December 13th, 1355. Its full Arabic title roughly translates to "A Gift to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Traveling." It's more commonly known as the Rila, although Rila is really a genre, essentially a travelogue within Islamic literature.
Ibn Battuta's Rila chronicles his travel through essentially the entire 14th century Muslim world. He had gone 75,000 miles, or 120,000 kilometers. That is three times farther than Marco Polo's journeys and three times the circumference of the earth. Along the way, he visited what's now 40 different modern countries. He met at least 60 heads of state and a wealth of lesser leaders and dignitaries, and he served as an advisor to at least 12 different rulers. He also met all three brothers of the ascetic that he had heard about so early in his journey and did indeed offer them greetings.
The Rila is about 1,000 pages long, and since he was reconstructing it from memory after the end of his travels, its chronology is sometimes a little bit mixed up or vague, but otherwise it stands as a wide-ranging account of what the Islamic world was like in the 14th century. The world was, and still is, huge, but is not at all monolithic. Its people are united by the core belief in the Quran and by the idea that the tenets of Islam create a bond that is greater than ethnicity or race.
Yeah, if you're looking at the chronology of his travels and you kind of go, does that make sense? You may have even thought, does that make sense in some of this episode so far? It's because he was basically reconstructing it later on. And sometimes talking about places that he passed through more than one time. So sometimes it seems a little mixed up. As Ibn Battuta traveled, he observed the diversity of Islam, seeing how it was filtered through Arab, Persian, Turkish, and Mongol cultures. He wrote about how people worshipped, how they interpreted the law, and what their holy sites were like, along with describing the cities themselves and their cuisine and their environment and things like whether they were clean.
The book gradually reveals some of Ibn Battuta's personality and tells us a little about the worldview of an educated, devout 14th century Muslim. He was a pious man who could sometimes come off as a bit of a busybody, even beyond what might be expected of a man whose job was to be a judge. But he was also gregarious and highly curious about the world. Otherwise, though, there's really very little about his personal life. For example, he married at least 7 women, and he had children with at least some of them, in addition to having numerous concubines. Although none of these people play a part in the text beyond the mention of their marriage or occasionally their death. And we also get nothing about his homecoming and what happened when he met friends and family that he'd been separated from for almost a quarter of a century, or when he learned how many of them had died in the Black Death.
And this was really typical of writing at the time. It was not considered really appropriate to be talking about your personal business in public anyway. So it would have been doubly inappropriate if he had filled his book up with a lot of personal details about his life. So like that is not atypical at all. Also, when we say he comes off sometimes as a bit of a busybody, the story that to me typifies that the best is there's one part in his Rila where he writes about going into a bathhouse and some of the men didn't have waist coverings on. And his response to this was to go to the governor of the town and to tell the governor of the town that there were some men in the bathhouse that didn't have waist coverings on, and then get the governor all riled up about it, followed by a crackdown on whether there were waist coverings in the bathhouses. On the one hand, it was expected that men would have waist coverings on.
Right.
On the other hand, there were definitely a lot of people involved in the situation who were like, man, Ibn Battuta, mind your business.
He went right to escalation on that one.
Yeah. So a lot of people in their descriptions of Ibn Battuta use words like kind of a fuss budget or a little judgmental. And that kind of account is why. So this book was largely unknown until the 19th century, really even in the Arabic speaking world, although various editions exist in libraries in North Africa and the Middle East dating from the time after it was written. It does not seem to have been very widely read between the 14th and 19th centuries. However, in a weird turn of events, French scholars found 5 manuscripts in Algeria after the French occupied Algeria in the 1830s, and these scholars began trying to piece together translations. A lot of the first translations in English were very heavily abridged, unsurprisingly, because it is 1,000 pages long. And a complete English language translation project started in 1929. The Hakluyt Society, which is an English society that publishes scholarly editions of primary source texts about travel and geography, which is an amazingly specific mission, published the first 3 volumes by the mid-20th century. But the 4th volume didn't come out until, I think, 1994.
And it's actually unclear when Ibn Battuta died, although it was in the year 700 in the Islamic calendar, which would have been 1368 or 1369. A tomb in Tangier is traditionally considered to be his, but we don't actually know if that's the case.
Today, there's also a shopping mall name for him in Dubai. And its courts are all themed after places that he went. And a lot of commentators are like, not sure if Ibn Battuta would have thought this was cool or not.
Yeah.
He did. I mean, obviously, he traveled for almost a quarter of a century in a time when travel was a lot more uncomfortable and time consuming than it is in a lot of the world today. But the fact that he was so particular about things, sometimes people are like, would Ibn Battuta walk in here and be like, oh yeah, this is cool, I like the look of this place? Or would he be more like, not sure?
Yeah, we don't know.
Don't really know.
Hey, Tracy, do you have listener mail from far afield?
I sure do. And it is a correction from Jacob. Jacob says, dear Tracy and Holly, I love the show and have heard almost every episode going all the way back. I'm so glad you're covering such a fascinating and dramatic period of history, especially since there is so much mythology and downright ignorance about it. I should take a moment and note we're talking about our Dunkirk evacuation episodes here, which he said in the title, but I did not read the title. I couldn't help but notice you said Nazi Germany invaded Denmark and Norway in May of 1940, essentially simultaneously with the invasion of the Low Countries and France. I believe the Scandinavian invasions began in early April 1940, so roughly 1 month before the start of the Western Offensive. And while certainly the two operations were well coordinated, they were not quite simultaneous. Thanks again for the great program. Best, Jacob. Jacob is exactly right. Not only was this 100% my error, it is an error I introduced in my own revisions of the script that was like I had written it correctly in the first place. And then as I was, you know, reading through and making sure everything was right, I was like, what am I even talking about? This was not in April. This was in May. It was not in May. It was in April. I had it right the first time. So that is my error. I apologize, especially because that is an error that meaningfully changes our description of things. It was not literally the next day after invading the Scandinavian countries that Germany invaded the Low Countries.
So what you're telling me is that you're not a perfect history robot.
Mm-mm. I'm super not a perfect history robot.
Shocking.
I think this has all of the categories of error that I hate the most. It is a mistake I made and not a mistake that was like repeated a lot of places that I also picked up. And it's also a mistake that meaningfully changed what we were saying rather than like we said that was Thursday and it was really Wednesday and it doesn't really affect anything in the long grand scheme of things. This one did. So I apologize. And thank you for Jacob and a couple of other people who have written to point that out. If you would like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/MissedInHistory and on Twitter at MissedInHistory. Our Tumblr and our Pinterest and our Instagram are all also Missed in History. You can come to our parent company's website, which is howstuffworks.com, and find all kinds of information about anything your heart desires. And you can come to our website, which is missedinhistory.com, where you will find show notes for all the episodes that Holly and I have done on the show. You will find a searchable archive of pretty much every episode ever. I shouldn't even say pretty much. It is literally every episode we have ever done of the show. You can do all that and a whole lot more at howstuffworks.com or missedinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.